Okay, turn with me to Jeremiah chapter 6. Jeremiah chapter 6. You know, we finished chapter 3 and 2 verses last time in chapter 4. I believe that was a couple of Wednesdays ago. And we got that done. And we're going to jump over from the rest of chapter 4 and chapter 5 to chapter 6. And there's a lot that has taken place here between the two chapters that we have kind of skipped over. And so we did it pretty much for a reason. And this is, before we get too far in, let's go ahead and introduce you. This is Jeremiah chapter 6, and the subject that we have taken up for the past year or a little better is the subject of walk. And it's study 63. And tonight's study is December the 2nd. 2015. Now the words walk appears in the 16th verse, I believe twice in the 16th verse and once in the 25th verse. But I doubt it we'll get that far tonight because there's a couple of places that we need to go off to look at as we go along in this chapter, but we need to kind of go back to chapter 3 by the way of remembrance and realize that it told us in chapter 3 that those from the north came down to Jerusalem, and this was the Assyrian army. And they set up camp in and around Zion and Jerusalem. And so this is basically what we're going to deal with tonight. And we'll go as far as we can go in chapter 6. But I've got my notes down through at least through 15. But
what chapter?
Chapter 6 of Jeremiah. And And you're going to see something different as we look at it here tonight. And I'll kind of point these things out as we go along. Jeremiah 6, it says, O ye children of Benjamin, gather yourselves to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem. Well, here's one right straight off the bat. You know, and chapter 3, Jehovah was asking the people to flee in. And now that this northern army has showed up and things have gone awry and they have evidently had a great impact upon those of Jerusalem, and whether it be those that were trying to worship God in truth or whether they were just there as Jews. But it says, O ye children of Benjamin, gather yourselves to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem and blow the trumpet in Tekoa and set up a sign of fire in Beth Hakkerem, for evil appeareth out of the north and great destruction. So this tells us quite a lot here that things are not good, and that the Assyrian army has come out of the north, and they have brought with them destruction, and not only the destruction, but they have brought chaos in terms of what's taking place. And it says, "Oh, ye children," if we go back and break it down, it says, "Oh, ye children, or you sons of Benjamin." Now, Benjamin, you know, the tribe of Benjamin is the part of the whole of those of Judah. And he says, "Gather yourselves," or come together as defenders of where you live. And they had a close connection, the sons of Benjamin, they had a real close connection with those of Jabesh. And that wasn't good either. So that didn't please God at all about who they consorted with and how things was going around Zion. And it says, "Gather yourselves to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem." And I made the note, and it said in Jeremiah 4:6, and we didn't, you know, we stopped off at 4:2. Again, it was to flee into. Here it is, to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem. Because it's pretty evident that Jerusalem itself is about to be taken in war. And so the tribe of Benjamin is told by Jehovah to get out of there and to take up, to gather themselves and to get ready to defend itself. And because it says to blow the trumpet and Tekoa. And you know, when it's happened down through the ages and down through the years, that the sound of a trumpet is many sounds, you know, and but one is to charge or to make battle, to make war. And there's other sounds that the trumpet makes for different things of those that are in the military. And I think those in the military understand that. And certainly it's one of these things that has gone on and on down through the ages. Now, Tekoa is a town, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right, is a town 5 miles south of Bethlehem. And you know, and it was about 10 miles from Jerusalem. So, Bethlehem was close by, and also, there were other, small places that were close by, and evidently Tekoa was one of them. And, so they were to blow the trumpet there and to set up a sign of fire in Beth Hesarim. And, so let's look at that a minute. Set up a sign of fire in Beth Hesarim. So you see, it's very close to Jerusalem. We're about 10 miles out of Jerusalem. And to set up a sign of fire is to raise up a fire signal or to set a fire And I kind of looked at this to be it might have been a diversion that they were pulling off. That when those Assyrians saw all the smoke and the trumpets and heard of it, whether they heard it or not, if they heard of it, it might have been a situation that they would leave where they were and go there. And it could have been a diversion deal, a fire signal. A sign of fire is 48:64. And Beth Hasserim is, it's one of these hyphenated words. And Beth, when you see this, these words with Beth in front of, some of these other words, it's really it can be as much as a house of or a family of. Beth means a family or a house. So, it necessarily wasn't where they were, wasn't a, what we would call a, maybe a town. But it was, more like, a grape vineyard or a place where vintners would, you know, work up their wine. And so, that was kind of the reason I thought that it might be a diversion. And it says, to set the fire in Beth Hakkerem, it means the family of grape vendors. For evil appeareth out of the north in great destruction. And see, all this was done, because of, what's said in the scripture and in the notes. It talks about the north there, those coming from the north. It said because the armies from Assyria entered the land from the north. And you go back to the third chapter in the 12th verse, and we covered that a few weeks ago, where these folks came down from the north. And it talks about destruction here. That's fracture or damage. And it also mentions it again in verse 14 of this same chapter 6. So it says, set up a sign of fire in Beth Hakkerem, for evil appeareth out of the north and great destruction. And then verse 2. Verse 2 is a short verse, but it says, I have likened the daughters of Zion to a comely and delicate woman. So in verse 2, it says, I have likened, or God is saying here, I have made a comparison. I have looked it, especially, you know, if you get into a war situation, the Assyrians are going to come in and, they're going to, make this destruction happen. And so, the Lord said, look, I've made a comparison. And the comparison to these women here is the daughter of Zion. And it is the word metonymy. And the comparison came out in the mind of God as helpless inhabitants. So, and he goes on and says to a comely and delicate woman, and certainly comely and delicate women have an inability to withstand, men of war. They have no defense. They can't really do anything other than what they're made or told to do. They become prisoners of war, rather quickly. And I think this is what happened. The daughters of Zion there, wouldn't be able to do very much, to defend themselves at all. Prey they are, and that's, certainly what they would, are, because, he's just told the children of Benjamin, or the sons of Benjamin, to flee from Jerusalem. And so if the men flee out together themselves to war, that pretty much leaves the women helpless in this situation. But God is really wrought with the folks, even those that the inhabitants of Jerusalem, because they had gotten into a situation where they had forgotten what their job was as far as dealing with God and putting forth his word to those that they came in contact with. Then in verse 3, we come up with some of the same words that we came up with in chapter 3, in verse 3. And it says in verse 3, the shepherds with their flocks shall come unto her, the daughter of Zion, and they shall pitch their tents against her round about. It's like they have surrounded them. And they shall feed everyone in his place. So let's look at that a little bit, because, you know, the picture here is a grim picture. And it's a picture that's not good with the children of Israel, especially the women folks. And it says, the shepherds with their flocks shall come unto her. Now, we talked about shepherds over in chapter 3. God said, I will give you pastors. And those pastors will give you knowledge and wisdom. And this is not shepherds with a bunch of sheep here. It is the Assyrian army. The Chaldean army. And they're not pastors. And they certainly will take advantage, every advantage. Now, you know, in a situation of war, that's a tough thing. And a lot of people have to do things to even stay alive. And so, you know, I'm looking at this as a far greater picture than what we just have here. But let's not read into it more than what there is. But it says, they shall pitch their tents against her round about. So I think the round about there is to encircle them, and take full advantage, whether it be cooking, whatever the needs of the army is, that would be what they would be called on to do. And it says, they shall feed everyone in his place. So the captives there is what the word they is, the women. And it, they shall feed. And feed there is 74:62, and that the word there in the English is raw. And when you look that up, you find that they will be evil and treated. And it talks about everyone, or I guess every soldier, if you will, in his place or his tent. Because I think we have we looked, yeah, it says, the shepherds with their flock shall come unto her, they shall pitch their tents against her round about. So the armies came with their tents, which that's what armies usually do. Stay in tents until they take the land or do whatever it is that they came to do. And it says everyone in his place or everyone in his own tent. So evidently they had enough captives to get their places or their tents in order. And I think that probably tells quite a bit. And then verse 4 says, he is talking again to the children of Benjamin. He says, prepare ye war against her. And it's to prosecute or exercise a holy war. So God is not going to let them just be walked on. He is going to do what he can against these people, but I assume they were greatly outnumbered, those that came down from the north. But here's a little clue, if you will, of what they were going to do. And he says, prepare your war against her, arise and let us go up at noon. It says, woe unto us, for the day goeth away, for the shadows of the evening are stretched out. So if you're going to prosecute a holy war, why would you do it at noon? Because there's a note in the Companion Bible that says, in the heat of the day, when most are resting or sleeping. So it appeared to me that they were going to go down, they're going to go over, and that was one reason why I thought all this fire stuff was a diversion, because they were going to go up at noon, and give themselves a surprising edge to those that were there, because at noontime it's hot and it wasn't really a good time to fight. So they were going to take a little edge there. As my old friend Bob Washnot used to say, the little Jewish percentage they were going to try to get. I guess this was another thing that, because he was an old army colonel, and yeah, I don't know how much he knew about scripture, but if he'd ever read this, I think he would have maybe chuckled a little bit, because he was always talking about if you had an edge up some way or another, that you had Jewish percentage. He always used that phrase, and I wondered sometimes. But it says in verse 4 also, woe unto us. So these Assyrians and Chaldeans had great numbers. And so it was not going to be just an afternoon battle. So it couldn't be done in that afternoon or that evening. So they said, woe unto us, for the day goeth away. Nighttime's going to overtake them. And, it's really tough to fight a battle when you can't see who your enemy is. And quite often, and even in today's vernacular, you have places and times that, the fighting kind of dies away because there's no way to light up a battlefield. It's just not a thing to do. It says the nighttime is going to overcome them, for the shadows of the evening are stretched out. So it's really hard to know who's friend or foe in darkness when you're trying to make war. So again, here in verse 5, there's another little trick that they were going to do. It says, arise and let us go by night and let us destroy her palaces. Arise is, again, is to prepare for this battle. And let us go by night or march in the darkness. Now, this is one thing that the people of that area had to their advantage. They knew the lay of the land, and they knew where the buildings were that these people were occupying or had taken. And because it said, let us go by night and let us destroy her palaces. We got knowledge. We've got the lay of the land. We know the lay of the land, and we also know the buildings. So it makes good sense to them to work this thing out this way. And not only that, it goes a little bit further in verse 6. It says, for thus had the Lord of hosts say, Jehovah, the Lord of hosts said, hew down trees and cast a mount against Jerusalem. This is the city to be visited. She is holy oppression in the midst of her. So here Jehovah is saying, hew down trees, cut trees, and place them against the city of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was a walled city. So what they were going to do was they were going to cut trees and get them somewhere there close. And then they were going to cast them out. They were going to pour earth on the trees from baskets where they would dig the dirt and put them up there to build a mountain or a mount, a breach, if you will, to where they could breach. And this was a temporary mound, and it's You know, you can see these type of things all down through history where men have decided to wall themselves in for protection, and that others would get out and wittingly devise some way for them to breach these things. And this is what this was what they were going to do. It didn't say to break through the wall, because look what Jehovah said. This is a city to be visited. Well, he didn't want to do any extra great damage to the city. He wanted it to be when these people left, whether they were beaten back or whether they just left by their own, you know, to tear this mound down wouldn't take too long, and it would be back like it was. It was made for visitation by all the world. And so that's the reason I feel like that it was there or placed there, that we might understand that that was why this little insertion was put in Holy Writ here. But not only that, another comparison is made here, because it says, she is holy oppression in the midst of her. And holy there is 3605, and it means coast, I believe, K-O-C-E or K-O-S-E, coast. And it means full. It means all or ever. If you say, you know, this is holy, it means it's all there, or it's fully there, or every part of it is there. But God is saying that she is holy. She is all, she is full, or she is every oppression. And oppression there is Oshek, 62:33. And oppression there is overflowed with deceitful, gotten fraud. So she is full of deceitful, gotten fraud, or all deceitfully gotten fraud, or every deceitfully gotten fraud was in the midst of her. Or, to put it another way, it was kind of like a disease. It was kind of like a cancer that eats from the inside, and this is what Jerusalem had become. It had become someone that was being eaten from the inside out like a cancer in that sense. And so God was not pleased with this here, and this was part of the reason of the picture that we're looking at, that you could see what's taking place. And then he goes on to expand on that there in verse 7. And verse 7 says, as a fountain casteth out her waters, so she casteth out her wickedness. Violence and spoil is heard in her. Before me continually is grief and wounds. So God is saying, well, boy, you know, I hear the things that are coming from here, and these sounds, none of them are good. And he says, as a fountain casteth out her waters. And we're talking here about, I think, as we look at it, as a bore. And that's what they called places where water came up out of the ground at that time, was a bore, a B-O-R. And we call it, or we look at it, as an artesian well, one that continually overflows with water. That water just flows out of it all the time. And we used to, I've been down to Florida, the Wickiwashi Springs. I don't know if any of you have ever been down there, but they had this big spring down there that bubbled up out of the ground, and they made a place there, and they had, they hired girls, you know, to put on these mermaid outfits, and they'd put on shows there. And but this bore, or this artesian well, if you will, that they came up out of that place, it was a river. Because they had a, it wasn't 100 yards downstream, they had a boat there that you got on and could ride down the river for a ways in the boat and back. And so it overflowed with water to a point that it would float a pretty good sized boat. And so he's making the illustration here, as a fountain casteth out her water, so she casteth out her wickedness. That's raw. And so it overflows her wicked means out into all directions. I know water seeks its lowest point, but as it comes up and comes out, and I'm reminded as I think back of how that spring or that artesian well went. I guess you could call it a well. It was a quite large expanse. It was like, must have been 50, 75 foot across. And it says she casteth out her wickedness. That's the picture you're getting here of those that were living in Jerusalem at that time. That there was no goodness within the area of Jerusalem at all. So she overflowed her wicked means in all directions. So I guess if it was that bad, the Assyrians were fitting right into that thing, and those that were there to take advantage. And it says, violence and spoils is heard in her. And we go back to verse 1 where it talked about great destruction and damage. Well, that's violence and spoils. Was heard in her. It was like that there was a continual cry going out. And it probably wasn't a good cry. And he says, is heard in her before me continually, is grief and wounds. So he says, before me, or what I see continually, is grief or harm, and wounds is hurt. So what he was looking at there in verse 7, he said, what's spewing out of Jerusalem now is like an artesian well, and the water is going everywhere. And and it's going as wickedness, and wickedness is abounding everywhere. And he says, all I hear is violence and spoils or destruction and damage. And he says, it comes before me continually. That's what I'm seeing, or that's what I'm hearing, is grief and wounds, is harm and hurt. And, you know, this is what man has done to God's creation there. And this was a place that was set up by God and meant to be a place where you could go for worship. And now you got Jeremiah speaking in verse 8. In verse 8 it says, "Be thou instructed, O Jerusalem, lest my soul depart from thee, lest I make thee desolate, a land not inhabited." So the picture is getting a little clearer even yet. "Be thou instructed, O Jerusalem." And this is what God has told Jeremiah to tell him. He says, "Allow me to tell you and warn you about my city." And he says, "Lest my soul," there's two "lest" in this verse. And "lest" is the same thing. It is 6435, and it is pronounced out of the Hebrew into the English, "pain." And that's not P-A-I-N, but it's P-A-N-E, like a window pane or a piece of glass. And it means removal. And, you know, the reason that you have windows in your house is to let light in, and they're usually in panes, meaning that if you break one, you don't break the whole thing, but you can remove one and replace it. And that's what the word means. It's removal. Okay? He says, "Lest my soul depart from thee." Or "lest" also can mean peradventure. So he says, "I, my soul, or my nephesh, or my spirit, depart or be removed from thee." So if God removes himself from them, then what's going to happen? "Lest I make thee desolate, a land not inhabited." And again, there, that is, "lest I make the desolate or unlivable." It is a place that when God moves out, it is going to become unlivable for mankind. And it's going to be a land there that will not be inhabited for a period of time. And so we see that this is something that I think was not entered into lightly. But it was something that God was fed up with concerning the place that it was supposed to be and the place that it had become. And whether or not man wants to take credit for it is beside the point. If God says, I'm going to depart from it, well, you can see when he kind of takes his hand away from it, things change. And they change rapidly. And so we get down to verse 9. And this again is the Lord of hosts. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, they shall thoroughly glean the remnant of Israel as a vine. Turn back thine hand as a grape gatherer into the baskets. So in verse 9 it says, thus saith the Lord of hosts. And this is Elohim Zebadioth. So this is Elohim Zebadioth. They shall thoroughly glean the remnant of Israel. Okay, we're talking about a portion of Israel here. And they is the armies of Assyria, is the they there, will thoroughly glean. And the word glean there, as all law, and it is to overdo, to take all, or to abuse a remainder or surviving portion. Now, the word glean shows up a couple of times before you get to the book of Ruth. And I think the word glean there is 59. 53 in the Strong's. And you remember in the book of Ruth, when they were gleaning the harvest out of the fields, they were told to leave the corners of the field, not to go, but to leave it for the poor and those that didn't have. And so that's what glean is, that you would leave a portion of the harvest or something there for those people that didn't have anything. And this was certainly a reminder to me when you talk about the remnant of Israel. And the remnant there is, of course, like I said, a remainder or a surviving portion. Where you see the word where it says as a vine, it says in some of the places it talks about, in one codex, it reads on the vine. So if you're going to leave something to be gleaned, it has to stay on the vine to get its nourishment or to get its, to stay there until someone has an opportunity to use it in some manner. And it says, turn back thine hand as a grape gatherer into the basket. You know, we talked up there in verse 1 about the Beth Hakkerem, and it was a family or a bunch of vintners that had evidently had a pretty vast vineyard, and certainly the army that came there would like either the fruit of the vine or the wine that could be had from, you know, those kind of places. So, we need to go back to Leviticus and look at this again for a minute, because the Lord talks about this, and, you know, you go back into the books of the law, and there's not very much that isn't something said about that it can be picked up somewhere else. So let's go to Leviticus 19, and if you got a companion Bible, it's on page 160. In my companion Bible, and I want to read Leviticus 19:10. Well, let's go back to 9. I'm sorry, because we need to understand what's going on here. And it says, "And when you reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field, neither shall thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest." So you see, there was something set up here in the law about leaving these things for the poor and the folks and the widows and the folks that didn't have. Verse 10. "And thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shall thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and the strangers. I am the Lord your God." Now, is there anything about that that we couldn't understand? Leviticus 19:9-10. So you see, the situation with gleaning had been around. And it says in verse 9 here, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, they shall thoroughly glean the remnant of Israel as a vine or on the vine. Turn back or take back your hand as a grape gatherer into the basket." You know, whenever you get done and your hand goes back into the basket, you have gotten it every bit. And that goes against the law of God. And so these here, verse 9, they're going to thoroughly glean the remnant of Israel. They're going to take them as if they were grapes on a vine. They were going to get them all. They weren't going to leave any. There wasn't any gleaning that was going to be had, because this is part of the cleaning out or cleaning up of the land, if you will. Gee, we're not getting very far. Then we get to verse 10, and we'll do verse 10 and we'll stop there. And verse 10 says this, "To whom shall I speak and give warning that they may hear? Behold, their ears is uncircumcised, and they cannot hearken. Behold, the word of God, or the word of the Lord, is unto them a reproach. They have no delight in it." And this was the reason that the gleaning was going to be done entirely. I mean, the remnant of Israel was going to be taken out. And the question was, to whom shall I speak and give warning that they may hear? And this is the insensibility of those that do not believe or trust in God or mind what he says to do. And then you got the two words here, behold, and they're used there to draw special attention to what's going to be said. Their ear is in sin or is uncircumcised. It is an ear that is not associated with a covenant God. And it says, and they cannot hearken. That is 71:81. And it means that it's one that cannot prick up the ears to hear. And if they did, they wouldn't believe what they heard anyway. But it was as if one would be deaf. They could hear, but they didn't understand. And then here's another special attention word. The word of the Lord is unto them a reproach. The word of the Lord, the word of Jehovah, is unto them, the Assyrians, a reproach. And the word reproach there is 2781, and it's kerpal, and it means a disgrace. So the word of Jehovah to the Assyrians would be a disgrace. And it says they have no delight in it. And the word delight there is 2654. And it's kahafatz. And it is pleasure or desire. So they have no pleasure or desire into the words of the Lord because they don't believe what's being said anyway. So the question was, to whom shall I speak and give warning? You see the insensibility of these people that they may hear? Well, they wouldn't hear. They didn't hear. And so, therefore, things go on. It's getting worse and worse. As the picture is drawn out, it certainly gets worse. And so we've run out of time, and we didn't get to verse 15. I wanted to get there, but we just plainly used up all our time. But we'll pick it up the next time that the Lord allows us to do this with the threatenings and the captivities that's going on there and the other things that God is bringing out about Jerusalem and the area of Zion, because it had gotten in such foul condition that he's truly going to give up on it. And so here we are. You know, one time he says, come on into it. And the next time he says, well, it's not worth it. Flee out of it. Because it's so bad, you're not going to get any good out of it anyway. It's going to be a place of war, place of battle. And what's being said from here on out for a ways is even worse than what we've talked about already. And so I'll just give you a little of that as a heads up, if you will. But we're going to go and look at the whole of the chapter, because the word walk appears three times in it. We'll hopefully get to,
why did they go
to them next time. And appreciate you being with us. And boy, we had a good supper and a good time with Ronnie and Lori. And it seems like everybody's in such a haste anymore until it's even hard to do that. But let's slow down and allow the Lord to bless us as he always does and lead and guide us. Let's close with a word of prayer. Again, Father, as we come to the end of another study, Lord, may it be something that needs to be seen and heard and understood, and to realize that your long suffering goes and goes and goes, but it just goes to a point. And that's the way it's been down through history. And that's the way it's been down through time. But we thank you most of all for that time before anything was ever created. And you and the Son got together and agreed that the Son would come and take away quite a bit of this that we have in the way of grace. That what he did for us was the greatest gift that man could ever get. That Jesus came and gave his own blood that we might not have to sacrifice blood. Because that when he sees us, he sees the blood of his Son. And as we come and draw near to a time that we associate with the birth of Christ, we realize and we understand by your word that it wasn't the birth, but it was the inception, the start of a being that would lay down what he had, his glory and all of the things that goes with it, for men and women that would do this kind of thing to their surroundings. How great your love is to us. And as we come tonight, again, we want to be reminded of how great God is and how truly miserable that man is without him. And we thank you for the day that we come to that understanding. Oh, Lord, help us to be the kind of person that we need to be. To uphold that faith and to have that love that is so precious to us. God bless. Watch over us. Be with us. Thank you again for the time and for those that give up their time to have this association through your word. Thank you for your unspeakable gifts. In Christ's name we ask you. Amen.